Welcome to Comics,
episode 249. This week, we talk about
Thunderbolts, Faith in Monsters.
Visit us at welcometocomics.com. Listen to past episodes, see what we're reading next, send us a message, or find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. This episode is supported by listeners like you. Go to patreon.com/welcometocomics.
And now, the cast review.
Anyways, so Deadpool came out last week.
Oh my god, I'm so excited to see it. I really want to see it.
Oh, you saw it, right, Brandon?
Yeah, Sam and I saw it on Valentine's Day.
Yes, Lucia and I did as well.
I made an executive decision that we wouldn't watch Kung Fu Panda 3 because I hadn't seen Kung Fu Panda 2, and I felt like I would be missing important plot lines.
Probably.
I mean, honestly, I don't want to take that risk, and mostly I wanted to see Deadpool.
Well, so, yes. I mean, Kung Fu Panda 3, probably. Did that actually come out? I know,
yeah.
Zoolander came out, and I felt bad for Zoolander that it was opening the same weekend as Deadpool.
It got a really bad review, too.
Well, then I don't feel that bad for it.
Yeah, I read the review, and apparently it's, like, garbage. Like, the first one was amazing. Like, no, you know, that's a clear proven Zoolander. The first one was amazing. And apparently
yeah,
the second one was just like, they tried too hard. Yeah, it's, the best review I've read is that the first one happened very organically, like all of the comedy just kind of flowed. And then the second one is just kind of recycled jokes. And then they pushed a lot of envelopes, and that was about it.
That's unfortunate. I was looking forward to it too.
But Deadpool was excellent.
Awesome.
Like, They really captured the attitude of Deadpool. Like, not just the character, but, like, the whole comic and stuff. And it it is not a kid's superhero movie at all.
There were 9 or 10 families in there with kids under 12.
I saw one family walk in while the movie was starting, but the kid must have been, like, 14 or so. And so I don't think they walked out, but, I heard families, like, walking out and stuff. So, I read something, I must have been on, like, Reddit or something like that, and the commenter said that the family had walked out during the first sex scene, and then the people were like, they didn't walk out during when a guy got decapitated or stabbed and stuff. And I thought that was really funny that it really talks about the state of America, that people are totally okay with somebody getting, like, decapitated or stabbed and things like that, but not a sex scene where you can't really see anything. I mean, you see Ryan Reynolds' butt, and there's a part later in the film with a strip club.
That's right.
But even in the sex scenes, it's clear that they're having sex, but you don't, like, see a vagina or anything, you know.
Well, you know, sex is evil, but decapitation is not. So, yeah. Good reasons.
Because that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Like, your kid is definitely going to have sex at some point, probably, but it's highly unlikely that your child is going to decapitate somebody. Especially with katanas. But
maybe you need to reevaluate your parenting. Maybe you're doing it wrong.
Am I? I'm focusing too much on the natural things that humans do and not enough on decapitation.
Yeah, you need to teach those children how to ruthlessly murder people, right?
Well, I'll take them to see Deadpool then.
Yeah, there you go.
My 4-year-old.
I mean, it teaches important life lessons, like how to avoid getting stabbed and not get shot in the face. And...
But Deadpool does not avoid those things.
No, but Deadpool's teaching, he's showing people this is what happens when you don't avoid it.
He heals.
No, he's showing that the other people die because they're not avoiding it.
Oh, right, okay. I see what you're saying. But anyways, Definitely go see it, Jen. It's so good.
I am psyched.
Like, the thing is, it was really interesting because there were trailers for, I think there were, before Deadpool started, I saw 4 trailers for superhero movies. It was Captain America Civil War, X-Men Apocalypse, Batman vs. Superman, and Suicide Squad. And, you know, I'm sure Captain America is going to be cool. X-Men will probably be pretty cool. Batman vs. Superman, I want it to be cool. I hope it will be. But Suicide Squad looked like it would be pretty fun in the same way that, or maybe not the same way, but in a similar fashion to Deadpool. And, you know, we've been having superhero movies for pretty regularly for, like, I don't even remember when Iron Man came out. 2008, maybe? We'll call it 10 years. It was probably not 10 years, but about 10 years.
No, we're closing up on 10, because Iron Man was, like,
I want to say 2008.
I think it was in, like, the middle of 2008.
But, you know, Deadpool was really, like, to use a cliche, it was a breath of fresh air when it comes to these, like, superhero movies. And because it's just something different. And
it also did really play true to the comic.
Yeah. But I think you don't have to be a comic book fan or a Deadpool fan to appreciate this movie. It's kind of like an 80s action movie in many ways, where it's got a strong sense of humor. But good action.
Oh, that's true.
And it was really good. I really enjoyed it, and it deserved all the accolades it's been getting.
Yep.
Awesome.
Yeah. So, speaking of anti-heroes, we read their Thunderbolts trade.
This week's comic.
This time we read Thunderbolts: Faith in Monsters by Warren Ellis, and this took place during Civil War, Marvel Civil War run. This is about the time when I first started. This might have been the first Thunderbolts book I read, actually. It's a good run. I really like Warren Ellis, and, I think this is a good place to start on Thunderbolts if you don't want to go all the way into the past.
If you don't want to live up all of that wonderful 90s dialogue.
Yeah. So, as you probably guessed, Brandon has joined us again to impart his wisdom about the Thunderbolts. So, Brandon, this is one of the ones you recommended. Do you remember why this is one of the ones you chose?
So, this one was actually a really important storyline, mostly because it's the formation of a new team, and it's under Norman Osborn, who, if you guys don't know, is the Green Goblin. And it's got 2 original members, and it's got 5 new members. Moonstone and Songbird are the original members that are still kicking around. And they have one of the Strucker twins. They have the Radioactive Man, which I love how wonderfully, like, generic his name is, but
he has no affiliation with the Simpsons character.
he's a Chinese national, and he can control different forms of radiation, and I feel really bad for him half the time because he's not actually like a danger to people, but they put him in a suit, that like a hazmat suit, and everybody's scared of him because of that. There's Penance, who was originally a character named Speedball, and due to the result of what happened to trigger Civil War, his powers changed, and he became a character named Penance. And he has probably one of the darkest transformations of any superhero I've ever read. And it's like beautifully tragic what happens to him, because he kind of has that cliched reawakening and kind of revival of his character, but in like the worst way.
So I did not realize that Penance was Speedball.
Oh,
yeah, that's really interesting.
They don't really make that clear in this trade.
Yeah.
Yeah, because so there's a comic, the comics line after this is called Caged Angels, which is another one I highly recommend. And it actually does go into his background of being Speedball. In this one, you're just kind of getting used to his penance persona. And there's a 5-issue miniseries about penance and his basically journey to do what his namesake is.
Sorry, go ahead, finish Brandon.
The other two members are Venom, but it's not the original Venom. It's Mac Gargan, who used to be the Scorpion. And in a bid to kind of save his life, the Venom symbiote was sold off to Mac Gargan. And, I always forget, was it Flash Thompson? No, Eddie Brock.
Eddie Brock.
Yeah, he sells the symbiote to basically the crime underground. And Mac Gargan wins the bid and becomes the new Venom. Except, there's a lot of turmoil about, like, he kind of doesn't realize what he signed up for. He thinks it's because he wore a power suit for, like, years. And he kind of doesn't know exactly how deep the Venom suit will get into him. And there's a lot of, like, kind of terrifying twists within that. And the final member is this kind of, like, unofficial, official member of Bullseye. And he's on an extremely short leash because mostly everybody else is kind of okay with not murdering everybody, except for Bullseye, who wants to murder the crap out of everybody.
Yep.
But, and then Norman Osborn is the leader, and he doesn't really participate in the field, but he's a very main, prominent character within this team.
For sure. So I was going to say, Jen, remember when we, a couple weeks ago, or 3 episodes ago or so, when we read Marvel Apes?
Mm-hmm.
And there was thing where Monkey Speedball met other Speedball's parents.
Yes.
So they didn't know that he was alive and dressed as Penance.
Oh, really?
I think, yeah. Because eventually he works through his issues and becomes Speedball again. I think during Fear Itself. I remember there's in Fear Itself he is Speedball again.
The end of Caged Angels, the storyline following this, he works with Doc Samson, and Doc Samson kind of shows him how to reroute his abilities in a way, and kind of mention, look, it's not a new persona that you can't go back to the old one. It's you are now two people, and you have to reconcile them being in yourself.
Yeah.
And he kind of shows him how to reawaken his Speedball powers.
Okay.
And to really follow it, you do need to read Caged Angels, and you do read to read the 5-issue miniseries. But it's very well written, and if you like the character, it's definitely worth checking out.
Yeah, Speedball is very central to the whole Civil War story or event, and so he kind of appears in a few different places. But yeah,
so in the context of this comic, Speedball is presumed dead, and nobody knows who Penance really is.
Well,
the Thunderbolts do.
The Thunderbolts do. The government knows who he is.
Okay.
He, like, turned himself in. So, for those not familiar with what caused Civil War, the New Warriors had a reality TV show, and they would basically, camera crew would follow them around when they would do superhero stuff. And they were fighting a mutant villain named Nitro, who basically had the power to create explosions. Like he would make an explosion with him at ground zero. And he, while the New Warriors were chasing him through Stamford, Connecticut, he blew up a school and killed like 300 school children. Everyone on the New Warriors died. And all the villains died except for Nitro and Speedball, because Speedball's powers saved him, because he absorbs
kinetic energy.
And so he got bounced away. So, like, he went, like, multiple states, like, away. And being the only surviving member of the New Warriors, he basically became the target of people's ire about the whole situation.
Mm.
And so eventually this leads to the superhuman Registration Act because people are mad that there's these powerful beings running around being vigilantes with no training and no government and no oversight, basically. And Penance, or Robbie Baldwin, who was Speedball, he feels incredibly guilty. He's got survivor's guilt and the guilt of, you know, being a part of this incident. And so he turns himself in and, becomes Penance, basically. And he wants to, I think he has, Brandon, is, maybe I'm imagining this, but the suit has like a spike inside it for every person that died.
So Penance has a very specific looking pain, activated ability when he's in the Penance guise and the build, when his character is written out like this. And when you see him without the suit, it's really terrifying kind of to realize, because Sweetball was that all-American, like, you know, blonde-haired, like, happy kid. And somehow, within all of this, he's covered in scars and cuts and bruises. And the suit spikes are both ways. So when he moves, the spikes dig into his body. I'm still not sure how you can see out of the helmet, because it's pretty much covering up his entire face. But, the chest piece is covered in spikes. The arm guards are covered in spikes. The legs, the helmet, like, everything. There's a scene later. There's an issue where he's talking to somebody, and somebody's kind of daring him to do something. And he takes a pen, and he stabs himself in the chest and drags it across and shows, like, this is nothing to me. I'm willing to do far worse. And it really shows an insanely dark side to him. It makes a very bold impression as to exactly what he's doing to himself.
That's actually really interesting.
It's super dark. It's very, very dark.
I was sad in this trade that they did not go very much into not even his story, but like not his character. I mean, we see him sitting in his unfurnished cell, and they talk about the suit a little, but we don't see much of what you guys just described.
It happens afterwards.
Yeah, they go into it a lot in the next trade, because he sits down with Doc Samson, who is a gamma-powered psychiatrist. No, he's a psychologist, right?
He's a psychologist, and he's also he comes out of the Hulk storylines. So he's the savage Doc Samson, and he has gamma powered, like, he's basically another Hulk, but his kind of like Hulk showing is that he's a really big dude with long green hair.
Yeah.
But,
he's an interesting character.
I always thought he was dumb until I read this, and I kind of got a little more acquainted with this character.
Yep. Okay. Jen, what did you think of this trade?
I really liked it. I like Warren Ellis, and I like his writing. I think that if you're going to deal with a team that was originally villains who kind of got reformed, and now they're just like government-certified villains, Dark is a good way to go. So I thought that, I like this a lot more than last week. The only thing I'm sad about is that we didn't read two trades, honestly. So, that's a pretty good reaction, I think. Because they didn't cover as much as I wish they had with each character. But I find, like, all the machinations fascinating. Like, Moonstone trying to take over and Songbird, you know, kind of realizing what's happening. And I also really like Radioactive Man and Swordsman.
He's a Mega Man villain now.
Yeah. the Swordsman story with his sister's skin on his sword is like super creepy. And the fact that he's like trying to revive her, that's like really interesting to me. And I'd like to see how that goes down.
There's a little bit of incest going on. Like, it's hinted at. It's very creepy.
That is not surprising at all.
later on they fight Kilgrave, and at one point, and it wasn't in this trade, but the Thunderbolts do fight Kilgrave, and when they're dealing with him, he pushes Swordsman to kind of like go a little crazier than usual, and he talks about his sister in a really creepy way.
Mm.
It's like, that was about, when I was flipping the page, I had reread it, and then I had to stop, and I had to go back. Because I was like, I read what now? And it just, it is really creepy. So Jen, did you notice the differences in Songbird from what we read previously to now?
Yes, absolutely.
Did you notice that huge kind of growing up? Like, she really...
Yes.
It's really refreshing that she actually has, like, real dialogue.
Well, you know, I think that's also a product of the 90s, because,
Yes, absolutely.
Like, the whole, like, young girl falling in love with a dude maybe twice her age is very 90s in my mind. I immediately think of, like, Kitty Pryde and Colossus, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
That's true.
And I think that... It was just, she was being written into that trope because that was a common way of writing. But here, I really appreciate that, we skip forward, not to where she's the leader, but where she had that and it was taken away, because it gives her character something really interesting to strive for, right? Before, like, her character was pretty one-dimensional. She didn't have anything aspirational she was doing as far as, like, the reader could tell, but here, you know, she has people that she genuinely wants to protect, and I kind of get the sense that out of them, she's probably the most reformed. She just has a tendency to commit fuck-ups.
Yep.
And I really, really liked Moonstone's, like, Baron Zemo mockery at her.
She pokes fun at that a lot.
I mean, it's kind of deserved.
Yeah, a bit.
But I just, I like the idea of seeing Songbird not just as, like, a really shitty villain, because I don't think there's anything interesting about Screaming Mimi whatsoever. But, like, to see her actually have personal issues that are developed and then later explored.
Yeah, it's reading through... And kind of, like, watching her, in a sense, grow up. Like, I forgot about it. Because, you know, I read it, I started it, like, around this point, and then I moved forward. And then going back and rereading everything from the beginning was very refreshing.
Yeah, I could imagine. Because I feel like, well, I don't know. Like, part of that for me is... I can imagine that if this is your status quo, like, it's all right, but then if you see how much the comic has changed since its earlier days, that makes it seem much better in its current iteration.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think one thing that is really strong about the whole Thunderbolts run from the beginning to up where it switched over to the Rick Remender Thunderbolt Ross team. I think it was Rick Remender. That whole run, like, the team kept not just growing, but the quality of the book continued to get better. It's one of those rare things where it was consistently good from start to finish. Even when it changed hands and the team changed, and, you know, I think the team changing was part of the reason why it was successful. But we don't really see it here, unfortunately, because we've only read two trades now. But if you were to read the whole thing, it's really good.
Yeah. I also do love the fact that they make, Norman Osborn look like Tommy Lee Jones.
Yes. I was going to say that. So, he looks exactly like Tommy Lee Jones.
So I don't think it's an intentional thing, but for some reason, on certain issues, every leader looks like somebody in real life. And later on, there's an issue of with Luke Cage as the leader, where he looks like Terry Crews.
Yeah.
And I have two copies of that comic, and one of them actually stays in my car on that off chance that I randomly do meet Terry Crews, and I want him to sign it.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's, and he's in a football stance, and it's like, it's so, like, perfect. It's so perfectly done.
Oh, man. The more we talk about this, the more excited I am to read future trades of it.
Yeah, the Thunderbolts are a consistently recommended team from, when I run into people who kind of go, oh, well, there's the Avengers, and they always know the Avengers. I mean, the Avengers always have, like, a stable roster, more or less. Like, you know the core members of the Avengers, and especially with the movies now, everybody knows those people as the Avengers, but when they kind of, people crave something different, this is a really great team to suggest, because it's like, okay, so what, at what point do you think that they're gonna like it? And then you kind of just make a suggestion, and it's almost always gonna hit.
Yeah, there's usually somebody on the team that is like a B or C list character that would be familiar to even casual readers.
And the people they fight, especially.
Yeah, so that's a good segue, Brandon. Thank you very much for that.
No problem.
So in this, we see them, you know, full on this, and they're full on government stooges in this trade, and they're off hunting. Some
unregistered.
Outlaws, unregistered heroes. So what did you guys think of those characters? This was my first experience with Jack Clegg, and, he comes back in one of my favorite comics. And so it's always fun to read this to me, cause.
Oh, he's a guardian, huh?
He becomes a guardian of a galaxy.
I forgot about that.
So here we see him get paralyzed by Bullseye. And like many of the other unregistered heroes, he gets sent to this negative zone prison. And he is in a wheelchair, and he is one of the few people who in the prison who is actually a hero and not a villain. And so there's a part in the comic where some aliens attack prison because they want to get to Earth. And the Guardians of the Galaxy come, like, roll up and try to save people. And one of the people that helps them is Jack Flagg. And so they take him away from the prison because it's been overrun by these aliens. And they take him to nowhere where they live. And because it's space, their technology is better, and they're able to unparalyze him. And then they ask him if he wants to go back to Earth, and he's like, hell no. He's like, I'm not going back there. I'm a criminal. And so he stays and becomes a guardian of the galaxy. It's pretty, and so he stays with the team until that run ends. So I'm always happy to see him.
Jack Flagg was a great fight too, because there's this really epic scene where the Thunderbolts convoy shows up, and there's like that superhero-esque walk, like cool guy walk, and there's the six of them in a row, and they're walking up to Jack Flagg, who's in a parking lot, like, by himself, and I'm like, okay, this is totally gonna get one-sided, they're totally gonna smash him, and he's gonna be totally, you know, out. It's gonna be a really lame fight, and he completely gives them a run for their money, and if not for, like, very key things that happened in the fight, I have a feeling he could have gotten away.
Yeah, I think, you know, if Bullseye hadn't been there, would have.
He had escaped until Bullseye got him.
Yeah. I mean, he takes out Swordsman. He, offsets Venom, which actually, this is what I was talking about, Jen, with, Venom's, like, instability and Matt Gargan's inability to control the symbiote. Because Eddie Brock was always kind of like that. Like, he was a partner in crime with Venom. Like, they had equal shares of control. And Matt Gargan, being already unbalanced, now has a symbiote who whispers to him and, like, terrifies him. And then when he's in a situation where he's emotionally compromised, he just completely becomes unbalanced and just goes nuts. And there's a panel before and after where he's normal-sized, and then he gets stabbed with that portion of Swordsman's sword.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up growing three times his size. he becomes massive.
And yeah, and then he, that's when he starts going on a rampage, right?
Yeah, and he's screaming, like, because the speech bubbles for him are all normal up until that point, and then they're giant red speech bubbles that say kill.
I didn't notice that the speech changed.
Yeah, so the way you can tell who's in charge with Matt Gargan, and this took me forever, one of my friends pointed it out, if you look at his eyes, so he gets stabbed and his eyes are white. Mm-hmm. Later, his speech bubbles turn yellow and his eyes are starting to turn red, and then later on his eyes are full-blown red.
Oh.
And that's the control shift.
Okay.
So that's who you can tell is officially in charge, is that, if you exclude the size completely, it's the color of his eyes and the color of his speech bubbles.
Interesting. I did not notice that at all.
I mean, I obsess a little bit over a lot of the details in these comics, but,
No, that's really cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see exactly how the shift, how quick the shift happens.
So, one thing about that fight that I really liked, well, first off, was it either of you who under Jack Flag in the notes wrote idiot?
No, that was not me.
Okay.
It might have been Andy.
I kind of figured it was Andy, but... Because I was, like, ready to come to Jack Flag's defense. I think he did the morally correct thing. But that fight was so good at showing how terrible a team the Thunderbolts are. And more than that, like, how terrible Moonstone is. Like, everything that Moonstone has done and that has happened to Moonstone in this trade have made me really want to see her downfall. Like,
it happens pretty much, like, I think a storyline or two after this.
That is not surprising, because she is bad at her job.
Yes, she is.
Also, I think last week we were talking about how, you mentioned, like, her role as a psychiatrist comes in, like, even more heavily.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoy this aspect of her where she thinks she's being so clever and manipulative, but she is really bad at it. Like, all she's actually doing, as far as I can tell, that's actually effective, is messing with Norman Osborn's prescriptions. And I don't think you need to be a psychiatrist to actually do that. So it's like, she's just fucking failed at this whole thing.
What, I think, David, when you and I were originally thumbing through these and we were kind of talking about it, I think the one thing that stuck about an observation, well, she's really, the only thing she's really good at is being bad at her jobs.
Well, she's terrible.
Yeah, I think that was the, because I was trying to, like, figure out, like, a lot about it, and because you had dived into it before me, you had explained, because I was like, I don't get this character, and you just, she's really good at being bad at everything she does.
Well, the thing, too, she's bad at her job on purpose. It's not because she's, like, how did this lady get a doc? Well, maybe, yeah. How did she get a doctorate? But she uses her position to be evil.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I almost feel with her, though, that at some point, like, she just decided to be evil as, like, a cover-up for her incompetence. Like, they said that, like, 6 of her patients committed suicide. I imagine that, like, the first 5, she's like, oh, shit. And then by number 6, she's like, I totally did that on purpose, guys. All of it. Like, I just can't see it panning out, because she is supposed to be this manipulative mastermind. And she's so bad at controlling people. I just, oh, man.
She's wonderfully bad at everything. Like, later on, I think when it's the Luke Cage era, she actually kind of falls in line a bit, because Luke Cage doesn't deal with anybody's shit.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's like, she really does have this kind of, like, forced arrogance of, like, look what I'm doing. I'm totally clever. And look at all these clever things I've done.
It's so blatant, too. Like, when she's clinging onto Swordsman, and talking about how she wants to run the Thunderbolts, there's no way he couldn't have noticed that she's trying to manipulate him. Like, it's just so weird. it's a really strange, like, comparison, because everything she does is one thing, and everything that she says is another.
Yeah.
Well, the thing, too, about the people that she's trying to manipulate is they're all, like, none of them are right in the head, except maybe Radioactive Man.
He's very loyal to his country, to it. Like, yeah. So he's through and through. He will mention, actually, a few times about his loyalty to the being a Chinese national. And especially in a comic, I think, that happens before this, he poisons Namor's ocean with radioactivity as a retaliation for something that Namor did to China. And it took a lot of convincing from a lot of characters to have him unpoison the sea. And you kind of, jumping off into this, you kind of get a rigid idea of what he's about and what he talks about. But he's a more interesting character once you understand his stances on a lot of stuff. Because other than that, he's just some guy who's green and controls radiation.
He was actually my favorite one in the trade. I think that he's probably the best one on the team at manipulation. The way he handles his discussion with Norman Osborn is actually, he kind of has like this sardonic sense of humor, and he I think knows how to get what he wants without really pushing people's buttons. And he also doesn't seem like a terrible person. I mean, it seems like he, like, if he follows Songbird, they could actually be heroes on the heroic version of the Thunderbolts team.
There's a pretty important piece of information about him, and that's actually mainly the fact of why he acts the way he does, is because he's not a criminal. He actually is there just as, like, a diplomatic thing.
Oh, I feel bad for him. Like, the idea that he's pent up with these psychopaths doing, like, basically reality TV government black ops is really sad.
Oh my god, Andy, edit that out.
Oh, I forgot about the Stan Lee part.
Oh, yeah. His cameo.
Oh, Stan Lee.
He had a cameo in Deadpool.
Yes, he did. It wasn't the cameo I was hoping for, though.
It was a good one, though.
It was. Oh, I forgot the terrible, like, civilian superheroes in this show.
What?
Because he talks...
Oh, yeah.
There's Stavity Jones with his knife suit.
Oh, yeah.
Hellsfang with his flamethrower mask. Doomstomp and his gasoline-powered death boots. Oh, God, it's so bad.
I really love their desire to make everything into a reality TV show, including the Thunderbolts doing their job. Like, I know Norman Osborn probably views it as, like, I don't know, good publicity, but damn, it's so stupid.
Yeah, there's, like, a toy commercial in this, and he explains to Songbird that she's, like, was it toyistic or something like that? That's toyetic.
Is that even a word? Like,
I don't know.
I don't know. I hope not.
It is. It is a word.
Oh, no.
But, the locker room scene with Matt Gargan, that was an interesting one.
That was creepy.
Yeah, that actually, there's a single speech bubble in this that shows the immediate dependence and, like, kind of, like, further proves the instability of Matt Gargan. And it's when he admits that he's not sure how he's lived so long without having the symbiote. It's very haunting, because I remember Matt Gargan being kind of like a goofy villain as the Scorpion, and this shows, like, a really human side to him.
Yeah, the idea that it's a bit of a torturous experience, and at the same time, you know, it's something he actually wants. And it makes you wonder, is it really him saying that, or is that some influence of the parasite?
Yeah, that's a really good point, because Matt Gargan I've always considered as, like, a B-rated villain. Like, he's not terribly exciting, but he's not, like, really lame. Because he was part of the Spider Slayers. Like, he was, you know, he's a pretty prominent character for the Spider-Man, like, rogues. So, he's not, I guess he would be, like, a B-plus villain, if you want to take that. But, this kind of made me more interested in the character in general. Just mostly on the fact that you kind of get to see a new side of him.
Yeah. I think they did a good job showing what they're planning to do with him in terms of development. Through very little time on the page.
Yes, definitely.
Hmm. Should we talk about the art at this point?
Yeah, I think my favorite part about the art was probably the Tommy Lee Jones cameo. But I mean, I guess it's more than a cameo, because we saw him multiple times. But, yeah, I think the art in this is actually really good. I think sometimes comics, you know, this is, I guess you could call this a grimdark comic. But I think they didn't artificially make things dark to add atmosphere, because even when they were fighting, you know, it's in broad daylight and the sun is shining and everything. But then the parts where we saw, like, somebody having a dark personal moment, like when Norman Osborn was slipping a little bit and becoming the Green Goblin, you know, the art reflected that atmosphere. There was a lot of shadows, and you know, got the red light from the setting sun in his office and stuff.
Yeah, the art felt really heavy for this one, and I mean that in a good way. I think it goes well with showing, I don't know, kind of that they're not goofy, reformed villains right now. Like, there was nothing goofy about it whatsoever, and I think that, considering the comic's past, that's an important thing to show.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, some of my favorite panels of, like, all time come out of this era of the Thunderbolts. Especially with, I forget her name. I forget what the hero's name is, but she,
Sepulchre?
Yeah, like, there's so much dark, like, heavy use in this of, like, blacks and... Except it doesn't really take away from the detail, which was very refreshing. Like, I was always kind of like, I've always been really nitpicky about, like, the way the art looks. Because if the art's not very good in the comic, I kind of get turned off and I'm way less interested in reading it, because that's what I'm mostly buying these comics for, is, you know, I want to look at the great art done in these. And they did not really take anything away by taking a shortcut by going, oh, a whole black panel. Here you go.
Yeah, they did the her powers really well, especially when they're showing what was it? Songbird communicating to, I think, Radioactive Man when they're all trapped in it.
Yeah, when she has him pulse the radiation.
Mm-hmm. That was probably my favorite panel.
When you could see everybody's skeleton and
yeah. That was really cool. Well done.
So, as we're in this part of the trade now, have you noticed the Venom switches?
Yes.
So you can see, like, there's the Venom portion screaming, and then, like, it switches over to Mac.
Yeah, and now that you've pointed it out, it's really obvious. That's actually, like, a really good way of cueing the audience to know, like, what's happening there.
The craziest part is not, like, you almost can't pick up on it unless somebody shows it to you.
Yeah, it was subtle, and then suddenly, you know, now that I see it, I'm, like, seeing it all the time.
Yeah. Oh, this is one of my favorite Mac Venom moments, where he eats Steel Spider's arm. Yeah, that really sinister, yeah. I'm not allowed to kill you, but I can do everything up to killing you. And then that whole, like, half page where he's just ripping his arm off, like, that was very shocking.
Yeah, I didn't expect that to happen. I expected Steel Spider to come away relatively unscathed.
But, so look at that half showing of his face. You see the red?
Mm-hmm.
And it's them sharing bring that bloodlust.
Hmm.
Because Mac's already unstable, and Venom is already hungry. That's actually a huge piece I never noticed. Because Spider-Man was never really a favorite of mine, so I always knew the villains, but I never kind of paid attention to them. But as I started getting into like the Spider-Verse stuff later on, and I kind of went back and reread a lot of things, the Eddie Brock Venom, the Matt Gargan Venom, and then the future of Agent Venom, like, each one of them, the symbiote has a different persona, and this version of Venom always talks about eating people. So, when you read Caged Angels, there's a scene where he blocks off an entire corridor, like meant to fill up with a tank. And he mentions that nobody gets by unless he gets a bite. And Venom threatens to, like, the Venom symbiote threatens to eat Matt Gargan when they're sitting alone together. Like, he mentions, like, a ton of times, like, don't do anything or I might eat you. Or, you know, just come on, buddy, let me take a bite. It's not that big of a deal. But, yeah, he mentions throughout the comics, like, a lot, how much he wants to eat people.
That's interesting, especially considering, like you said, the shared bloodlust. Like, that's something I just kind of assumed it was the symbiote doing it, and now I'm kind of creeped out by both of them.
This is actually my favorite version of Venom, just because it's so unstable. It leads to good, interesting situations. Not good for the characters, but good for the reader.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, and his arm-eating session gets mentioned later on in Caged Angels, because everybody's terrified of him, and he doesn't understand why, and people have to kind of point out, like, you did eat a guy's arm. Like, this is, it's not normal. People don't do that regularly.
Oh, man.
There's the Penance Meltdown panel. He screws up, and he starts hitting his head against the wall without the helmet, and he's chanting, I'm not good enough.
That was a bit melodramatic for me. I think that was a part where it actually lost me a bit, where I was kind of like, that's too much to be full. Fully believable.
It makes more sense if you've read more about his kind of, like, individual stuff. But in the context of just kind of showing up, and you're like, okay, well, this guy's weird. I don't understand why he's doing this, but I'm just going to keep moving.
Yeah.
Oh, the second fall of Bullseye.
Oh, man. They played Bullseye so good. I really liked that. Because he deserves it, and the whole time they build up to him deserving it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love that he gets beaten by a man named American Eagle.
Yes. Like,
a character you would totally expect Bullseye to kill. And, like, he just totally slaps him around and has no issues beating him.
Yeah, I expected that American Eagle would just get wrecked. And I was super surprised when he won that fight, like, without any question, so.
Yeah, I had to look into him, because I was like, who is this guy? Well, that's a random Native American man beating up Bullseye.
Yeah, I think we've seen him in some other stuff. He just kind of is one of those side characters who tends to crop up here and there in, like, everything. At some point.
Yeah. He ends up back being in, like, a vegetative state-ish, where his body is useless, but his mind is active. And it's kind of a fitting end for him.
Yeah, I mean, it gives you a good sense that he's gotten what he has had coming for a very long time. Especially since, like, it's shown really clearly that it's his one big fear.
Yeah, especially in the start of this trade when he has that kind of hallucination-ish thing where Daredevil's holding the gun to his head.
Yeah.
And I had to look into that more just because I'm not a huge Daredevil fan. I like the show because I thought it was really well done. But in general, the character I just don't think is very interesting to me.
Okay. I feel like we've covered pretty much.
I was going to say, in response to Brandon, that if you want to read a good Daredevil run, I read the Mark Waid Daredevil over the summer, and it was really good.
Yeah, I think we were mentioning, I think we had mentioned that earlier when we were hanging out, that there were a bunch of comics that I should read that you had picked up, and I think that was one of them.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah, Jen, I think you're right. I think we're ready to move on to the rating of this comic.
Yeah, I'm excited to rate this one, so.
All right, Jen.
I'll do it.
Take it away, then.
I'm going to give this a 4. I really enjoyed reading it. I think that it's a good starting place to see what the team is about. And it has a fair amount of nuance regarding that pretty much all of the characters. I think everyone's developed fairly well, where at the very least you get a sense of the trajectory that they're going to go in future trades. I liked the art. I thought it worked really well. And yeah, I am actually really looking forward to reading the second trade of it and so on and so on. So yeah, a 4.
All right. Brandon, why don't you go?
Yeah, this one's probably like 4, 4.5 for me, especially since it's one of the ones I started with. There's so many things about this comic that got me into so many more comics and definitely got me hooked on the whole Thunderbolts as a team. There's so much in this that kind of makes you go, okay, so who is this guy? Oh my god, they're dealing with this now, and this is not like a normal hero comic. They're really bad heroes. And it's one of the ones that is usually on the top of my recommended, like, hey, you want a new team to read about? Check out this trade. And I think it's actually one of the few physical trades that I've loaned out on multiple occasions to people.
All right.
Cool.
I'm also gonna give this a 4. I think this is probably one of, this is probably, I don't know if I want to say this is the best Thunderbolts, trade, but it's one of the stronger entries in the run. It's a great place to start off, like Brandon said, if you're interested in reading about this team. But more than that, I think it's just a solid comic, you know? I think it's a better way of dealing with or showing, villains doing, maybe not heroic things, but they're the good guys from the view of the, American people in this comic. And, like you said, Jen, it's very nuanced and, you know, the storytelling's really solid and the art's great. There's just not much, bad stuff you can say about this comic. And it definitely leaves me wanting to read the next trade. Even though I've read it already, I'm gonna go back and read it again. So it's a 4 for me as well.
Sweet.
Yeah. It's really late, so I think we'll skip our trivia again. So for next week, we're going to read, we're gonna have one more episode with Brandon, and we're gonna read, we're going to skip forward in time again, and we're going to read Thunderbolts Cage by Jeff Parker with art by Kev Walker. And this is one of, I don't know if this is the first trade with Luke Cage, but it's this is post Civil War, post Secret Invasion, where Luke Cage is now in charge of the Thunderbolts. He fills the Norman Osborn role on the team, except he actually joins him in the field. This is actually, really good, and we get there's a whole new roster of people of questionable character that join the team. So, I'm looking forward to it. Thank you again for listening. We will talk to you next, you'll hear us talk to you next week. So goodbye.
Bye.